All right, thank you, Brother Darrell. Appreciate that. I call your attention this evening to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. I hope that you have been doing what I asked you to do beginning about 5 weeks ago. I hope that once a week that you read through the book of James. One of the things that you can do is take about 10 minutes, no more than 15 minutes, and you can read all five chapters. And if you will read this book every week until we get through it, you will know it like the back of your hand. You will be able to finish verses that other people start from the book because you have read it and you have read it and you have read it. And so, if you haven't begun doing it, it's not too late. I mean, we're still in chapter 1. We're only in verse 12. And I've preached out of chapter 1, verse 1, verses 2 through 4, verses 5 through 8, 9 through 11, and then tonight, verse 12 only. And so, I hope that as we go through this, that you'll realize the practicality of it, hence the name Everyday Christianity. That's the name that I wanted to give it because there's so many just little practical things that are in the book. We're going to find one more tonight. Now, look with me at verse 12. Blessed is the man. And when the Bible uses the term the man, in a situation like this, it's a generic term. It can mean men or women. So blessed is the person, I guess we could say, that endureth temptation. For when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. When I think of the word blessed, I just think of the word happy. And so I titled the message tonight, A Happy Man. And anytime I hear the word happy now, I can't think of anybody's face but Phil Robertson. The guy that is on the Duck Dynasty thing. Happy, happy, happy. You know, he's a Christian, and he's just content in the Lord. And so I think whenever I see the word blessed, I think of the word happy. As a matter of fact, the word blessed means happy. And if you were going to get some other descriptions, it would be something like to make large, to be envied, richly rewarded, intensely happy, those types of things. And so when he says blessed, think about a man that is just really happy even when he's enduring temptation. So when I look at this one verse, I want to ask you something. When you dig in the Bible, what are some of the things that you're supposed to do? What are some of the questions that you're supposed to ask? Well, one of the things that you're supposed to ask, and this is going to be our outline for tonight, what does the verse say? So in other words, you want to know, what does it say? The second thing that you want to know is, what do the verses around the verse say? Because you see, you can take one verse, and if you try to build a doctrine on that one particular verse without getting it in the context, you could get all out of shape. You can put emphasis on certain verses in certain places, and if you emphasize certain things, you've got really doctrine that's false doctrine. One of the probably verses that I think of most often is one over in Philippians where it says, look not on your own things, but look on the things of others. Well, if you take that just at face value, in other words, you know, don't look at your cars, look at the other guy's car because that's what you want. You know, then there's another verse that says, let him that stole steal no more, but let him labor with his own hands. Well, if you change that inflection, you could say, let him that stole steal no more, let him labor with his own hands. And so when you're reading, the second question is, what do the verses around it say? Well, what else does the chapter say? That's our third thought. What does the whole book have to deal with? And so then the last thing is, what does the Bible in other places say about the same words or the same phrases? And so it's just a little simple exercise for us this evening, just to use with this verse. And so let's take each of those questions tonight and kind of wade through this verse together. When we look at the first part, it says, blessed or happy is the man. He's not sad. He's thinking about the trials that he's going through, but he's still okay. Well, not only that, but it says, he that endures. And what does he endure? Well, he endures temptation. Now, before I open up the word temptation, I want you to think about endures. When you think about something that just endures, you just think about something that's strong. You think about something that is just like a rock. I was telling someone yesterday, we were talking, and they had come over to our house and were a part of a cookout that we had with some family and friends yesterday. And I was talking about one of the little mottos that we use around here. It's called Building Lives by the Book. And I've added to that little motto something to create the idea of strength or endurance, something that is just steadfast. It's Building Lives by the Book since 1913, which is when the church was founded. And so for over 100 years now, 104 years, this church has been a Bible-believing church. And I want it to continue to be a Bible-believing church. When we look at the Bible, that is our rule book. And so when it says the man that endures, he just stands. Well, as I began to think about that, I just kept thinking about this one passage of Scripture over in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And actually, it's 2 Corinthians chapter 4. It says, we are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We're perplexed, but we're not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed. I heard one preacher 40 years ago preach on this passage, and the title of his message was, Knocked Down, But Not Knocked Out. Knocked down, but not knocked out. And so when you think of endurance, think of somebody that just stands. I mean, they may be being pummeled from one side or the other, but they just stand. But then you look at the word temptation. And that word temptation is a little different than the word tempted in verse 13. And this is kind of like two things that are competing with each other. And one of the things that you may want to do in your Bible is, if you've got a pen or a pencil, the word for temptation in verse 12 has the idea of a trial, some suffering that you're going through, a test that you're going through. It's the same word that's found in verse number 2. In verse 2, it says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers or various temptations or testings. And so the temptation in verse 2, the temptation in verse 12, in the Greek it has the idea of a trial, something that you're being tested with. You go through it, and if you endure that testing, you're going to come forth looking pretty good at the judgment seat. In verse 13, which we will get to next week, it's a whole different way to look at it. It's a solicitation to do evil. And so next week we will talk about temptation in our traditional sense? Well, if you look back at our verse, it says, for when he is tried. Again, there's that same little phrase in verse 2, when you fall into various temptations. And in verse 12, when he is tried. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. It doesn't matter who you are, some point in your life, you are going to be tested. It may be a financial test, it may be a health test, it may be a family test. It can come in a lot of different ways, but you are going to be tested at various times. There's a movement about that that is called the prosperity gospel. And they tell people, if you come to Christ, you won't have any problems. The only problem is this: you can't point to any verses in the Bible to substantiate it. You're going to have problems. The guy that suffered more than anybody that we have probably thought of, biblically, is probably old Job. I mean, this guy lost everything he had materially. He lost every one of his kids to a storm, and a house fell on him. Here he is sitting in a heap of ashes, taking old broken pieces of pottery and just scraping his skin to try to get some ease. And his wife looks at him and she said, why don't you just curse God and die? God bless supportive wives. I tell people that God got her back though. Because after God restored him, God gave him 10 more kids. That meant she was pregnant for 90 months. And so you've got old Job that suffered and suffered and suffered, but he said, you speak as a foolish woman. He said, though he slay me, I'll trust him. Though skin worms devour my body, I'll trust him. That is a guy that just stands. And so, you've got this temptation, this testing. And then, there's a word that is the word crown. Matter of fact, it says crown of life. And the word crown here has the idea of the victor's crown. The Greek word is Stephanos. And in ancient times, they would have games. In the area of Judea, there was a great builder. He was the one that was alive when Jesus was born. His name was Herod the Great. He built a huge city over on the Mediterranean Sea called Caesarea Maritima, or Caesarea by the Sea. And there was a huge 7,000-seat auditorium where they would put plays on, but they would also have games there. And then out away from the theater is a thing called a hippodrome. And that's kind of an oval shape where they would have horse races. And they would have events and athletic contests, much like they had in Athens, Greece. And throughout the New Testament, Paul uses all types of athletic metaphors. And so when he says, you're going to receive the crown of life, there's going to be a reward one day for those that have endured, they have stood, and the Lord has promised those people that have endured, if they love him, he's promised them that crown of life. Now we're going to come back to that thought here in just a little bit. And so that's the first question. What does the verse say? And so when you read a verse, just read it slowly. Take it in little bite-sized segments. Blessed is the man. Endures temptation. When he is tried, he will receive the crown of life. For the Lord's promised that to those that love him. And so the second question now is this. What about the verses that surround us so that we can make sure that we're staying focused on the context? Well, we began And James just identified himself as a servant. In the first verse, we know who he's writing to, and so there's no question it's to believers. They're Jewish believers, but they're still believers. And they have been scattered. They're no longer in what is called the area known as Palestine. They're no longer there. Persecution from the Jewish authorities has begun to come heavily, and because these people are Jews, they have lost their jobs, they have lost their homes, they have been basically run out of town, so to speak. And James writes to them, and then he says, "You rejoice." Well, then he tells them, "You endure." And then he tells them, if you're having a hard time, ask God. He'll give you the wisdom to know how to make decisions as you're suffering. And then you make sure that you've got the right perspective. You make sure that if you still have a little bit of wealth left, that you don't trust in that. You trust in God, just like somebody that has nothing. So get your perspective right in verses 9 through 11. And we won't get to it, as I mentioned, but if you bounce past verse 12 down into 13, it'll talk about the temptations or the tempting to sin. You bounce over a little bit farther along in this chapter, and he talks about being a hearer of the word, or a doer of the word, not just a hearer only. He talks about if somebody seems to be religious, but they don't keep their mouth shut, their religion is in vain. And so that is the context. It's just everyday Christianity. So we're at the part right now of the trials and the sufferings. And then the third question is, or fourth question, what does the Bible have to say about the subjects that we're discussing? Well, let me ask you a question. I'll get a little audience participation tonight. If I say the word blessed, where does your mind go to scripturally? That's exactly right. The Beatitudes. Hold your place here in James, and let's go to Matthew chapter 5. The Gospel of Matthew chapter 5. Jesus is preaching probably one of his most, if not the most famous, certainly probably the top two sermons that he's ever preached. I personally like one over later. I like his last sermon better than this one. But that's just me, all right? But in verse number one, we see that he's got a multitude of people there. And so what does he do? He goes up into a mountain. His disciples come up there, and he begins to preach this to 12 men. And in verse 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 9, he uses the word blessed to start each one of them. I don't want to focus on those, even though we could preach a message on each one of those, and maybe at some point in the future we will do that. But I want you to look with me at verse 10. In verse 10, it says, "Blessed are they which are persecuted." They're persecuted for righteousness' sake. They're trying to do right, but they're being persecuted for it. There are times when you, as a Christian, will be persecuted for trying to do right. You're not greater than your master. If you look back at verse 10, it says, "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then verse 11, "Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake." In other words, everything that they say about you is deceitful. They spread innuendo about you. They want to take you out, so to speak. And what does he say? He says, "Rejoice." That's the same word that James used when he said greetings in verse 1 of chapter 1. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. So in other words, when you think of blessed, you think, well, Sermon on the Mount. That's where I go. Well, when you think about the Sermon on the Mount, you know what that tells you? It tells you how we're supposed to live. But do you know what the Sermon on the Mount does not do? It doesn't give you the ability to do it. Can you think of something else that tells you how to live, but it doesn't give you the ability to do it? What about the Old Testament law? Is that not what Paul said? He said, the law is a schoolmaster. It tells us what to do. Well, when we read the Gospel of Matthew, he tells us how we're supposed to live our lives. But it's not until Pentecost that the power to do it is given. When the Holy Spirit of God was given to us, and we became indwelt by the Spirit of God, we have the power now to pull it off. And so, when we look at Pentecost, we see that is where we've gained the ability to live right. Now, flip back over to our passage in James chapter 1. So we have the blessed man, and he just stands, he endures temptation. For when he has tried, when he has suffered, what is he going to do? He's going to receive the crown of life. Now, the crown of life is only mentioned in one other place in your New Testament. And what I want us to do is I want us to go now to the book of Revelation. I want you to go to chapter 2, and I want us to look at a church in Revelation chapter 2, the only other place that the term the crown of life is mentioned in the New Testament. There's three levels of trials that we find in verse 9 and 10. Remember, the church that he's writing to is the church at Smyrna. This is one of seven churches in an area that is modern-day Turkey. It was called Asia Minor. And what does Jesus say to that church? If you got a red letter Bible, you can see the words of Jesus, and it's in red. Look at verse 9. I know thy works, and tribulation, and poverty. And then he inserts this little parenthesis, but thou art rich. And they're probably thinking, say what? We don't have anything. We are trying our best to live for God, but tribulation's all around us. We're poor, but Jesus is saying, you're rich. And he says, and I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but they are the synagogue of Satan. So there's three levels of testing. And the first one that we see is we see there's the human aspect of it. There could be times when we face human trials. There are people that literally have lost their jobs because they would not accept a PC culture that maybe they were employed in. There are people that have had their businesses closed because they had certain convictions against certain things because the Bible condemned it. I can think of a bakery, I can think of a florist, and I can think of a photographer. And all three of them had their businesses basically ruined because they did not believe in same-sex marriage. And so there's the human part of suffering. And we see this here in Revelation. And Jesus tells this church at Smyrna, he said, you're going to be persecuted. There's going to be suffering. And it's going to be they that are of the synagogue of Satan. In other words, those people that are not Satan worshipers necessarily, but they are in the control of the god of this world. If you don't think that Satan is in control of the people of this world, you got your head in the sand. When you see things and headlines that are on the news sites that are what I call aggregate news sites, where they just kind of pick things from all over the place, and you begin to read the various stories, and you may read 15 or 20 of them in a day. Some of the things that are out there is just, it's horrible. I think it was in New York City, either this morning or last night. Guy walks up to a lady that was a policeman. Just shoots her. Right there on the street. I believe that kind of stuff is, I believe that is promoted. It may be with the evil of humans, but I believe that takes us to our second level of suffering, and I believe that comes from Satan himself. Look with me at verse 10. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil. He's already been mentioned, the synagogue of Satan. So in other words, he's already in play in verse 9. But now in verse 10, it says, behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. You say, what does the 10 days mean? I think it means 10 days. I think it's a period of time. Now, there's some people that think that it means 10 different periods during the tribulation period. I just read it and it says you're going to be persecuted, the people of Smyrna, for 10 days. And I believe that this particular tribulation is going to last 10 days. It's going to be a week and a half. And so, you have the second level, which is satanic. You've got human, you've got satanic, but there's a third one. Look at the latter part of verse 10. Be thou faithful unto death. In other words, God knows exactly what's going on, but you just be faithful. You just stand. And if you do that, there's a divine purpose that God has allowed you to go through. And if you stand and you don't fall, what takes place? And I will give thee a crown of life. That's the second time our phrase is used. Now go back to James. In our passage, it says that if we endure and we receive the crown of life, the third thought is this: well, who gets this crown? In other words, those that go through the suffering, what's their motivation? Are they motivated because they're just rough and tough? No. It tells us the people that are going to receive it, it says, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. So in other words, if we love God, and that love is so strong that we endure the sufferings that we must go through, we can receive the crown of life. Now, when I think of love, Do you think of a Hollywood-type love? I don't. When I think of a Hollywood-type love, I think that's really more lust than it is love. I mean, it's a resume enhancement if you've been married about seven times. You know, it's like the old joke about Liz Taylor said to her seventh husband. It's what some preachers say. I'm gonna tell you what Liz Taylor used to say to her seventh husband. I won't keep you for long. Well, it's a resume enhancement out there. And it's all because it's about a feeling. But genuine love is not defined that way. Genuine love is defined biblically. And do you know where the best place to find that is? 1 Corinthians 13. So we have looked at our verse. We've looked at the verses around it. We've looked at the chapter and the book around it. And we've looked at some other Bible places. So let's close tonight with what is biblical love and how can we love God to get that crown of life. All right? If you want to write it down, 1 Corinthians 13, and we'll begin in verse 4. All right? And I'll just give you the little bullet points that Paul gives the Corinthian people. First of all, love suffers long. That means that you put up with a lot. Not only that, it's kind. It's not striking out. In other words, you're trying to heap coals of kindness on people. So if you love God, your basic thinking ought to be, I need to try to be kind to people because they don't know the Lord. It doesn't envy. In other words, we don't look at other people and say, I really want what they've got. There's a contentment about us. It vaunteth not itself. That basically means it doesn't flaunt itself or push itself to the front. You know, when you have people in business, one of the sayings that they have is, you know, hey, it's a dog-eat-dog world, you know. You're trying to climb that corporate ladder, you know, just, hey, pull off those in front of you and kick those that are trying to get past you. But that's not the biblical way. If we are true lovers of Jesus Christ, then we are not trying to push ourselves to the front. It's not puffed up. In other words, there's not a prideful attitude in love. In other words, if you love your wife or you love your husband, you know, you're not trying to constantly denigrate them and put them down. You're supposed to be a builder. You're supposed to put them in front of you. And so it's not puffed up. It doesn't behave itself unseemly. That means improper. It doesn't seek her own. It's not easily provoked. In other words, it doesn't fly off the handle every chance it gets. I mean, there's the old saying, people would drop, you know, one guy'd fight at the drop of a hat and he'd drop the hat. You know, one of the things about being a preacher, you know, we really focus a lot on, you know, being a husband of one wife and making sure he's not drinking. But you know, one of the qualifications of a preacher, he's not supposed to be a brawler. He's supposed to be a gentle type man. That don't mean he can't be tough, but he's not looking to pop somebody every time somebody gets out of line. And so he's not easily provoked. He doesn't go around thinking evil. Let me give you a test. I want you to blurt out the first word when I say a word, I want you to give me your word association. Samson and Delilah. Old Jezebel type woman. That's what you're thinking. You know why? Because you like to think evil. Did you know it says about Samson that he was, that the Spirit of God came upon him more times than anybody else in the Old Testament? We don't think about the strong man that killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. We don't think about a guy that was smart enough to catch 300 foxes, tie their tails together, set them on fire, and let them go through the Philistine cornfields. We don't think of that. Oh no, we got to think about Delilah. Now I'm going to tell you, I do too. Samson had a woman problem. There's no doubt about it. But we always have a tendency to go there first. I guarantee you, if I call this next name, you'll give me one of two names. David and one of them's Goliath and the other one's Bathsheba. Isn't that right? We don't go David, a man after God's own heart. Nope. Old David and Bathsheba or David and Goliath. It's one of those two most of the time. And it's because we have a tendency to think evil. But we ought to give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, we ought to make sure that if we think something, we think, my thinking's off. Until it has been verified in several sources, just think good. Don't think evil. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity, but it does rejoice in the truth. It bears all things, believeth all things, hopes all things. And the last thing that little passage says in verse number 7, it says, endures all things. So if we want to get that crown of life, let's be happy, even though we don't like going through those trials. We can still have the joy of the Lord in our hearts. The joy of the Lord is our strength is a song that Brother Darrell leads us in from time to time. And I hope that it'll be a truth that we're not lying when we sing it. And no matter what comes, I hope that we'll still have the joy of the Lord no matter what frustrations come. No matter what trials, sufferings come, let's just stand. Let's just stand. Why? Because we love God and that we want to have that crown of life when the Lord either comes to get us or we go to be with Him in glory. Let's stand together.